It was welcome, everybody. It's been a few months till we finally got the program off the ground, and it's a pleasure to welcome everybody. And I want to thank the Beit and Rabbi Korofkin for hosting and joining in the program. And I want to thank all our speakers. We're going to begin the evening with a short film from YU. YU Connects, and then we'll have our panel discussion afterwards, question and answer period. So we'll start in one moment. I just want to thank Esther and Craig Guthman for their sponsorship in memory of Esther's mother, whose yahrzeit was back in January when we had originally planned the program, but it's always appropriate to do learning and programs all year, and we should have only Simchas for many, many years. So I want to thank Ian and Pam Rosemarin, and without further ado, we will start with the Bakasha.
Hello, I'm Dr. Elliot Malman, and welcome to another Torah Motion panel discussion. I'm smiling because, you know, when I said to Jay a couple of years ago, we should really do something on this shidduch thing. I had no idea what I was getting into. I'm going to bring, sort of breathe a big sigh of relief when it's over and get back to easy stuff like, does God exist or what's the meaning of life, you know, things like that. So I'm really delighted to introduce to you our panelists in alphabetical order, and they're going to help us sort out fact from fiction in the shidduch world. So right next to me is Aliza Abrams. She's the director of the Department of Jewish Service Learning at Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future. Aliza holds a BA in Judaic Studies from Stern College for Women and a master's in social work from the Wurzweiler School of Social Work. And over the last number of years, she's led over 20 different service missions around the world. She sent over 3,000 students on Torah tours. In addition, she's lectured in the UK and Israel, Brazil, Ukraine, all over North America. And she's a member of the inaugural Wexler Field Fellows Program through the Wexler Foundation. On her right is Rabbi Simcha Feuerman. He serves as the Director of Operations for Ohel, Children's Home and Family Services. He also serves as President of Nefesh International, the trade association of Orthodox mental health professionals. In addition, he maintains a private psychotherapy practice where he specializes in high-conflict couples and families. His latest book, which is co-authored with his wife, Chaya Feuerman, is titled Marriage 9/11, or 9/11, and is available in bookstores and through Amazon as a Kindle book. Next to me, of course, Rabbi Daniel Korofkin, who's the rabbinic leader of the Beit here in Thornhill, Ontario. Rabbi Korofkin received his rabbinic ordination from Neri Yisrael College in Baltimore. And he has an MA in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA's Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures. He also has a Master's of Science from Johns Hopkins School of Engineering at the Applied Physics Laboratory. Before moving to Canada in 2011, he was Rosh Kehillah of Yavna in Los Angeles, and he is the author of a new translation of the classic philosophical work, The Kuzari, in defense of a despised faith. On the far left, Rabbi Hananya Weissman, who's the founder of End the Madness, which is a grassroots effort to bring about what he calls sanity back to the shidduch world. He's the author of several books, including the newly published End the Madness, Guide to the Shidduch World. Rabbi Weissman is also the founder of Hot Kiddush, a way for Jews to meet and network online for free. Many of his articles are available at www.hananyaweissman.com. Please welcome our panelists. All right, I wanted to really start out with a title here, which is the Shidduch Crisis, and I think we should begin with defining the issue. There are a number of writers and figures in the Orthodox world who proclaim Shidduch Crisis. Here's one example of an article that appeared on the OU website. Quote, "Treat the topic of singles like the crisis that it is. It is a plague affecting all segments of Orthodoxy, and it threatens our very continuity. Synagogues and organizations must put this on the front burner. Singles themselves must change attitudes. Women must put marriage before career. Men must consider the woman as a valued helpmate, not just as a means of advancing their own life goals, be it career or learning. There is more to a human being's worth other than their money or looks, end quote. On the other hand, see, it's a metaphor. The one mic can't get along with the other mic. On the other hand, others have written emphatically that the shidduch crisis does not exist, that in Rabbi Josh Yoder's words, it's a collection of myths which only exacerbate the social pressures and anxieties at the core of the Jewish singles community, specifically the denial of individuation. So I want each of you to explain, we'll start with Rabbi Karapkin, to explain to us what constitutes a shidduch crisis. Is there one? Isn't there one? And why are some people in frum communities so alarmed?
Oh my, so I don't know why you're starting with me. I'm the least qualified on this panel. I do not have a specialty in the single scene. But we have many singles in our community, and we've had a lot of experience over the years. And first, let me just thank our sponsors once again, the Gutmans and the Rosemarins, and Torah in Motion, and Dr. Malamet, and Rabbi Kelman. Does a shidduch crisis exist? Well, a crisis is, it's an age-old philosophical question about what is reality. Is this reality exist in my mind, or does it exist ontologically outside of my mind? There is a crisis if there's a perception that there's a crisis, then I guess a crisis does exist. If young ladies are crying themselves to sleep at night because no one's responding to their shidduch resume, so then we have a crisis. If young men are being have misplaced values and are making unreasonable demands on the young ladies that they go out with, so then we do have a crisis. But on the other hand, if we have young men and women who are eventually finding their bashert, but it just takes a little bit of time, and eventually they figure it out, and sometimes they have to bump into a few walls on the way because they thought that they were going a certain route of the shidduch process, and they realize that they don't fit in that world and they want to try something else, and eventually they find their way, then no, I don't think that necessarily there is a crisis if in the end we have a room full of married people. So I do see both sides of the coin, but it's I do think that there's an unnecessary amount of anxiety that has been generated.
When a 40-year-old man who's married and has kids realizes that he doesn't like his job very much, he's wondering where his life is going, he doesn't feel very fulfilled in life, so he goes out and he buys a sports car and he runs away for a little while. What do we call that? A midlife crisis. Is that really a crisis? I don't think so. I think it's overblown. But nobody's offended by the term. Is it a crisis? Is it just a collection of very serious problems? I don't think it matters very much. I think we have bigger things that we can battle on. You know, I have very passionate opinions about these issues. This is not one of them that I think really resonates. You know, there are very serious problems. There are real problems. We need to talk about them. We need to address them. What we call it, the precise choice of words that we use to refer to these problems, I think is not that important. There are major problems, and the fact is that for every single who desperately wants to get married and is struggling to do so, and the people who care about those singles, it is a crisis, and it's very real for those people. I personally care very much about those singles, so for me, I think it is a crisis. And for anybody who cares about singles, for them it's a crisis. Whether you choose to call it a crisis or not, I don't think it's that important, though.
So first, I want to thank you for having me here, and the community, thank you for hosting us. So by a show of hands, please, who here got married after age 22? Thank you. Who here has a child that's still single? And who here is involved or considers themselves involved with shidduchim? Okay, great. Thank you. That was very helpful. When I hear the word crisis, and you might recognize me because I'm the girl in the video, I look a little different now, my hair is different. I said
there were a lot of girls in the video.
I was one of the girls. I said the deli roll line.
Oh, that was,
that was me. Okay. The first time I saw that video at a conference, everyone walked up to me and just went, oh, deli roll. So anyways, in terms of the crisis, as I said in the video, and I'll say it now, and I'll say it for years, every time someone uses their word crisis, it makes me feel worse about myself. What is going on in Nigeria right now is a crisis. There are 200 girls that are missing. My friends and I that are not married, that are close to 30 or over 30, that's unfortunate. And I do feel that it's a sad thing that we're not married yet, but we lead fulfilling lives, we lead happy lives, and we're not crying ourselves to sleep. Maybe there's a night every now and then that you do, because I think everyone does, but it's not a crisis, but our community has told us that it's a crisis, and our community has made us feel that it's not okay that we graduated college and we didn't get married, or that we're living in a singles community for over 5, 6, 10 years. And that's where the crisis lies. It's the lack of sensitivity and the words that are used that makes us question who we are and where we're standing in our lives.
Did you want to add anything? Or?
Sure. You know, I'm just reacting to the first quote that you stated, and I think when people experience times of social change and the impact and the chaos and confusion that comes from the changing of roles, the changing of requirements, changing of the rules of the game, which are all going on at a more and more rapid pace because of technology, I think there's a very strong drive to want to move toward traditional values, and I think that the article is out of context, so I don't know what else the person was saying, but clearly those sentences, the person was in a very reactive state, and he wants everybody to go back 100 years to some place that might not have actually felt better for anybody, but from where we're standing, it certainly looked a lot more romantic and interesting. And I think that that's a very big challenge, that we all are inhabitants of a world that's in transition and times that are in transition. And for sure, that means that the music's going to stop and some people are going to be left without a chair, whether you're talking about the job market because the world is changing, or you're talking about the shidduch market because the world is changing and the demands that are going on are very, very different. And so, you know, whether it's a crisis or not, again, everybody has meditated on that word, but certainly there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of difficulty in understanding the roles and understanding the rules of the game and trying to figure out what chair you're going to take when the music, you know, actually stops. I think that very similar to divorce, you have to think about this for a moment to digest what I'm saying, but very similar to divorce, the reason why there are more singles and the reason why there's more divorce is simply because they can. They can. We have more choice today. And that means that people can choose to leave relationships that they're not happy in. Now, I'm not making moral judgment about whether that's a good choice or a bad choice. My bread and butter is trying to save marriages. I'm really not in favor of divorce. But the reality is that many people leave relationships because they have an option to do so. And many people stay single because they have an option to do so. And that doesn't mean I'm not blaming anybody at all. What I'm trying to say is that the more choices there are and the less restrictions there are on the roles, actually in some ways the more imprisoning it is. It's very difficult to make choices. And the thought of choosing a marriage partner or, quote, settling, it's very similar to the idea of people being in a marriage that's loveless, but they used to stay together and now they don't. And so there are very complex, not one-size-fits-all answers to these questions, certainly. And it requires a lot of study, and I think it requires a lot of work with the people that we know to help them figure out the rules of the game. But in that sense, I think there's a crisis because there's a shifting. There's a shifting in almost every which way that we live. And that's what makes life very stressful for us today.
That's actually a kind of a curious paradox that you're alluding to here. And I think that's part of my confusion. What's the paradox? See, on the one hand, you're talking about a truth, which is that modernity is about autonomy. It's about choice. It's about people freely individuating their lives. But the material on the film and the material that sort of has come my way in researching this topic is about no choice, right? Is about the idea that the system seems much more restricted, more confined. You talked about history. everybody sort of knows or has spoken to somebody who's sort of articulated this idea that, and Gail Hockman on the film talked about this, there was a time when people just met each other. There was a time where you got a phone number and you phoned and you went out on a date and you decided whether you liked the person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet what we're hearing now is that the system is actually much more constricted, not about choice. So there seems to be a kind of internal contradiction taking place here. I'm wondering if you could weed that out for me a bit.
Well, I think that the community is reacting to having so much choice, and therefore, you know, for example, right today there's much more anxiety disorders, not just in the religious community. There's actually mixed studies about whether or not religious people are more anxious, but in the world at large, there's a lot more prevalence of anxiety disorders. And part of the reason of that is, very similarly, if you have your primary needs taken care of, and you're not worried about getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or getting attacked by a cassock or whatever it is, you then have this free-floating kind of anxiety that's almost biological and existential, and you have nothing to attach it to. And so you start fretting, or you start becoming more religious, or you start paying attention to details that nobody worried about before. And so, to a certain degree, I think that's part of the game. If I could share, I don't want to talk too long, but thank God my wife and I were successfully able to witness the marrying of two of our older children, and it was a very difficult time, you know, the shidduch process. And we're also sort of, we don't belong in a particular category, because in terms of our mode of dress and our practice, I would say we consider ourselves yeshivish, but our attitudes are socially progressive. My wife is a therapist, I'm a therapist. You know, our attitudes are very much socially progressive. So by more than one person over the 2 or 3 years that I was trying to help my daughter get married, was accosted. How could you insist that you're not going to support your son-in-law? People literally grabbed us in the street and predicted doom. And actually, all that we said was that we'd be very proud to have a son-in-law who wants to study Torah. We just simply are not making any promises. We just would have to take it from month to month, as the good Lord would allow. And this one thing was like seismic. People stopped us on the street and kind of practically threatened us with that our daughter would never get married. She got married to actually a very, very bright fellow who now is in podiatry school, but he's big Talmid Chacham too. But the point is that it was crazy. The pressure was insane. I don't know what it was coming from. We weren't even telling anybody what to do. We just were saying, no thank you. We're not willing to talk about money before marriage. That's all we said. We just said those words, and people were driving us crazy. So there's something going on. I don't know what it is. It worked out for us, but...
I hear you. Lisa, let's talk about looks, okay? Because, you know, for me, this was kind of anthropology I was learning about. I sort of treated this like there's people here in a world called shidduch, and it struck me that the elephant in the room was always looks and money. You know, everybody was talking about midot and X, Y, and Z, but what I kept seeing was looks and money. And this was sort of reiterated for me in quite a well-known column that was printed 2 years ago by a woman named Yita Halberstam. I'm just going to quote you a little bit from it. I found it quite startling, and I think you will too. But once you get past your reaction, I'd be interested in whether you think this is truth. She wrote a column on Shidduchim, and she writes as follows, quote, "Yes, it is somewhat disillusioning that men dedicated to full-time Torah learning possess what these girls might perceive are superficial values, but brass tacks, they want a spouse to whom they are attracted. The young men themselves might be too shy or ashamed to admit it, but their mothers won't hesitate to ask what for some is the deal-maker, deal-breaker question, quote, is she pretty, unquote. Mothers, this is my plea to you. There's no reason in today's day and age with the panoply of cosmetic and surgical procedures available why any girl can't be transformed into a swan. Borrow the money if you have to. It's an investment in your daughter's future, her life." I'm not actually done. "So, my dear, sweet mothers, who are bristling with indignation at my thesis, and feel deeply offended by my proposition. She's got that right. Please do not be hurt by what I am suggesting. I truly want to help. If your daughter's shidduch prospects are being hampered by a flaw or a problem that can be banished or remedied, please give her the emotional and financial support to correct it. Yes, I know we all want to be cherished for who we are inside, but whether we like it or not, appearances do count. So this article engendered a good deal of reaction, and much of it was understandably negative. But others, you know, the woman from Fairlawn, Gail Hoffman, in the film, actually wrote in saying she thinks she's right. She wrote in and said that although it's very unpalatable, it is reality and we ignore it at our peril. So my question to all of you is as follows. Of course, we all acknowledge that attraction is important, but also that it's subjective. She's making more radical propositions, like we really have to swallow our pride and go for it. What do you think?
So you know how there are things that you think but you don't say out loud? That's one of those, in my opinion. Look, I'll be honest. I'm somebody who always struggled with my exterior, my appearance, am I pretty enough? Am I thin enough? Am I good enough? Am I tall enough? Am I too tall? Am I this or am I that? And it always weighed on me and still does. But to make a comment that girls should, or that mothers should borrow money to have their daughters get plastic surgery is really reinforcing a very unhealthy sense of self. But I would be lying if I said that both men and women don't care about looks. We all are attracted to people, and we all know what we like and what we don't like. And it is important that people put their best foot forward. I myself, earlier this year, I was on a hishtadlus kick. I have a sister who's 9 years younger than me that's getting married in Mirtz Hashem at the end of June. And so while she was about to get engaged, I was like, okay, I got to work on this. And I went and met with three different shadchanim. And they were reviewing my profile, and they said, wow, you are so much prettier in person. You have to change your picture. Yeah, it's so good to see you too. Now, I chose that picture because I thought that I looked good in that picture. So after the first shadchan said that, I got upset, probably cried a little bit. The second shadchan, I was like, okay, that's twice in 1 week, fine. Third shadchan, I said, that's it. I'm creating an event. I am taking over a hair salon, I'm hiring a photographer, I'm hiring a makeup artist. I put together a whole day, a whole pamper yourself, whatever you wanted to call it day, advertised it through YU Connects, advertised it to my friends, and three girls signed up. Now, I was shocked because I thought to myself, here it sounds like such a fun girl's day out. Why wouldn't anybody want to get their hair and makeup done and get their picture taken? And I realized that there was two things that were going on. People are comfortable with how they look, and they don't want to be told that they don't look good. Now, that doesn't mean that they should go out schlumpy and not looking nice. But if we tell somebody, you really don't look the way you should, not only does she feel terrible about herself, but that's not going to help her ego in general be a healthy person in a relationship, because she's always going to be thinking, well, what does he think? Does this look okay? Does that look okay? Or what does she think? Do I look okay or not? And it's a really unfortunate way that we're treating it. And I'll end with this quickly. This morning when I was at the gym, and I go to the gym at 6:15 in the morning so that I can be healthy, and there was a clip on TV of a show that was basically like a 3-minute reel of this relationship between two characters. And it was so romanticized and so not real. And yet I found myself thinking, huh, maybe that'll happen to me one day. And that's the problem, is that we're so, we're so influenced by the media and by the non-Jewish perspective on looks and relationships that it infiltrates into who we are and the emphasis that we put on these things. And I think, like Gail said, you know, in Mirtz Hashem, people are going to have children. They're not going to be the same size when they get married. But people can't really think fast forward to that, but everyone has to put their best foot forward, but be realistic in that people are really beautiful in different ways.
Physical beauty has been a criterion for matches from the times of the Talmud. You know the story, I've mentioned it from the pulpit for people who are members here, that on Tu B'Av, girls would go out into the field in white dresses and dance before the young bacharim. I lament the good old days. Today that could never happen because the rabbis would not allow it. The problem, however, is that the Gemara says that there were girls who were quite attractive. The girls who were attractive would make a point of saying, Ein Isha El Liofi, that the purpose of a woman is for her external beauty. And the Gemara acknowledges that when a man has a beautiful wife, it gives him harchavat hadat, it gives him a certain sense of menucha, of a machaya, a nice home, a beautiful wife. Those are things that actually ameliorate and enhance a person's life. So the fact to suggest that that's not a criterion, that's not a consideration at all, that's simply not true. To make that the number one criterion and to say that a person should artificially alter their appearance, that's a distortion as well. There was at one point, I don't know if it still exists, in New York, a very serious problem of anorexia among girls in certain communities in New York. And obviously, that's a distortion. When it becomes the number one criterion, when it becomes overemphasized, that's wrong. And I have to tell you that perhaps in one end of the Orthodox spectrum, it's overemphasized. But it's also not good to feel so comfortable with yourself that you're not willing to take beauty tips. My wife, who's involved with Shiduchim, has offered some tips to some young ladies who have come to meet her and, quite frankly, have looked a little schlumpy. I have to tell you, and if you think I'm shallow, I'm sorry, but this is what I feel. I looked at the video, and I saw some of the girls. One girl had oily hair. I wouldn't want to set her up with my son. I'm sorry for saying that, but, you know, if you're going to be on video, you should prepare for it. Another girl was a little bit zoptic. That's not a problem, but she wasn't dressed in a way and her hair was not made up in a way that would make her, put forward her best foot as far as in the appearance department. Everyone has a good feature. For some, it's their eyes. For some, it's their nose. Whatever their jawline, whatever it is, but every girl, and to some extent the boys as well, should go through some level of education as far as how you make yourself over to make yourself presentable for a shidduch.
Very few people are going to marry somebody that they don't find physically attractive, and I think that's a good thing. Every woman should feel that the man that she's married to thinks that she's the most beautiful woman on earth, and every man should feel that his wife thinks he's the most handsome person on earth. And they're probably both wrong, and that's okay. It's fine. This is part of the nature that God put into human beings. And we all understand when somebody goes on a job interview that they dress differently than when they're going to the beach or when they're going out with their friends for pizza. We just understand that. And it's okay that to educate people that when they go out on dates, they have to pay a little bit more attention to how they appear on the dates. Now, I think it's very easy to knock the author of that article for going to some, wild extremes here. I think we're all basically on the same page with that. But at least in principle, it does make sense that people should be educated that looks do matter. The way you show yourself to others matters, and there's really nothing wrong with that in principle. It's just how far we're willing to go with that. I don't have a problem with that. But one thing I will say is that if a similar article was written that was not knocking the women, but knocking the men, saying men are a bunch of schlumps and losers and they don't know how to dress, I don't think it would get quite the same criticism from people. I think that something that rankles me, that even in that video that we saw, everybody was knocking the guys. The guys were knocking the guys. Oh, there's not enough good guys out there. The women are also wonderful. The guys are a bunch of losers. Why don't more people find that offensive? I don't think guys are losers. I know plenty of wonderful single men who are educated, have good personalities, who make wonderful husbands and fathers. They're not losers. There are plenty of great guys out there. There are plenty of great women out there. We don't have to knock the genders. There's really no need for that. And I think women often get a free pass and get all this sympathy. There's plenty of good guys out there that are also having a difficult time.
If I can just follow.
Some of this is obviously about Western influence, as we all know. There's a tremendous amount of focus on looks and appearance, and the programming is so nonstop, and it doesn't matter what community you're from. You can be from an extremely sheltered and restricted community. It's just a matter of how you play the game. So you cover certain parts and you reveal other parts. There's a Gemara in Shabbos that goes into all the different types of dress and makeup because it has to do with carrying on Shabbos, but inadvertently they talk about a locale where the women cover everything except for one eye, and that one eye is heavily made up. You know, so it doesn't matter which community you're from, you really can't be completely free from the westernized influences. And anorexia, by the way, in the last couple of years is on the rise in men, because as time goes on, the effects, the pernicious influence of focusing on the body and the superficiality and insecurity, which is really a place for the free-floating anxiety to attach to, does end up, and it progresses. So men are starting to go through this too. There's a couple of things I want to say about this. First of all, the Torah is not politically correct. It doesn't really care about being politically correct. And in fact, all the imahos and many of the avos were described as yifas Torah and yifas mara. And it was mentioned as a virtue. It is a virtue to be beautiful. What that really means, it requires quite a bit of thought. But clearly there is something to that. I think that the author, I really don't, again, there's a lot of context here in what the author was saying, but to Don or Lekaschut, I will tell you, and I'll say with men to keep it safe, we have a lot of singles at our house for Shabbos, and you see people, and every now and then you come across somebody who, it's not that they're ugly in totality, that's a different story, people have different gifts, and people have different strengths, but they have one feature that's really killing them. There was this guy, really charming guy. He's 30 years old. His nose was not just a nose. I mean, we're all Jewish here. This nose was a nose. His whole face was a nose. And my wife and I, after dinner, we just were talking to ourselves, and we were just wondering. I mean, this guy was just a guest, so we weren't going to say anything. But he's over 30 years old. Did any of his Rashi Yeshiva, did anybody say to him, "Guy, it's the nose. You're a good guy, but your nose is just, it's not regular, it's a mum. It needs to be repaired. It's not just, like I said, some people are more handsome, some people are less handsome. But this guy, halachically, it was a mum. He needed to have it repaired." And I don't know if anybody would have the guts to tell him that. So if that's what the author of the article is saying, then more power to her. Because sometimes a person needs to be told. It's not only about looks. It could be about character. If someone is not getting married after a couple of years, they should get objective feedback. What am I doing that's throwing people off the trail, if I am doing anything? What's going on? It could be looks, it could be mannerisms. Sometimes people need that feedback. So, I'm all for that. I'm all for people trying to look good. I'm obviously not all for putting, 18-year-old girls under the knife so that they could, boost their status. But I think it's important not to, not to beat around the bush on this issue.
Okay, that's fine. I just want to go back to a word that you used, distortion, because I think, if you talk about looks, you talk about other things they talk about in the film, a lot of it seems to revolve around this notion of distortion. Like, I'm wondering, how do we get to this place today, and I'm just basing it on what I'm reading and I'm watching, where we're talking about tablecloths, and we're talking about plates, and we're talking about pictures, and we're talking about sizes of dresses. When all of us, I mean, I'm assuming I speak for many of us, like when we dated, we didn't talk about that. I certainly didn't talk about that. I talked about my existential anxieties and, and so on.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, Baruch Hashem. But you understand what I'm saying. Like, how did we get to this place? And I know I'm going to ask Rabbi Weissman to speak in a minute, because I know you talk about this in your book. There's a kind of historical arc that's taken place here. And I really want to know, like, how did we get to this place of, like, pictures and plates and bios and fax resumes, and nobody seems to actually date. It seems to be this kind of orchestrated, almost like a play, right? And how do we get there?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important to distinguish, as has already been done tonight, between the two different ends of orthodoxy. The yeshivish orthodoxy, which is very strict about the resume and about the shidduch process, and the other end, which is more tolerant of the social outlets, where resumes and these kinds of superficial requirements are not as emphasized because young men and women are allowed to meet each other in a much more open atmosphere. So if you're asking, from the yeshivish side,
sure.
I think that number one,
Thank you.
These I think they were coming originally from a good place. But distortions take place because no one has bothered to speak up and say, stop the madness, except, I guess, for Rabbi Weissman. But in the yeshivish world, people are very selective in the Das Torah that they seek out. It's just the reality. If it's Das Torah that resonates with me, so then that's Das Torah that comes from Har Sinai. But if it's not, if it's something that someone, a Rosh Hashiva, will say that I don't particularly like or agree with, or it's too difficult, so then that's someone else's Rosh Hashiva and it doesn't resonate with me. And that's how distortions take place. I think the grossest distortion in the yeshiva world is the expectation that is given to young ladies and to young men that when you get married, it's a requirement for the young lady and or her family to support the young man in learning. That was never the value until the 20th century, and it was never something that was expected. And for some very bizarre reason, that has become, in many communities, the norm. That, to me, is the biggest problem, the financial burden that is being placed on a young girl and her family, which is creating an onerous burden.
I think the reason why people ask these kinds of questions is because they think it's a good idea, and they think that it will give them some insight or some information as to whether this shidduch really makes sense. If people don't think these questions are a good idea, they should stop asking them. They should find better questions. And when people ask them those types of insane questions, they should say, I don't want to go out with somebody who asks these types of questions. The fact that you asked me that question tells me a lot more about you than you'll learn about me from my answer. That's really the way things are going to change. It's all about social pressure. People feel pressure to answer these questions. People feel pressure to go along with the system. People feel pressure to have these resumes, 80% of which says nothing about them, by the way. If somebody gave me one piece of paper to talk about myself, I wouldn't spend 80% of it talking about my relatives and other people. I would use it all about myself. That's just what I would do. I don't have a resume for this, by the way. But if I did, in theory, I would use it all to talk about me. Most resumes are not like that. It's about choices people make. What side of yourself do you want to show people? Are you confident in yourself and who you are, that you can be real with other people? Instead of putting on a mask, trying to live up to some image that nobody can clearly outline, but this is the way you're supposed to be to fit in, this power of neutral person who doesn't have opinions, who doesn't have a personality, who doesn't have dreams and goals that are different than the next person's, who doesn't have opinions, who doesn't have flaws, just this power of neutral thing, but you're really wonderful. If that's not who you are, then don't be that way. That's not the way you'll find the person who's right to spend life with. You have to be real. So I think people need to choose to not answer these questions, and they need to choose to throw these questions back at the people who ask them, and saying, how dare you ask that? You know, that's really not at all appropriate, and I wouldn't date somebody who was so petty and so shallow to ask that type of question. And if enough people have the confidence and the true faith in God to do that, then that will turn the social pressure around, and that will cause positive change instead of negative change.
You know how when a little child takes his father's car keys, puts on his hat, puts on his jacket, and he has all these totems of manhood, and he feels like he's like his father, even though he's really not. But as a child, he assumes if you hold the keys to the car, the magical keys to the car, and you wear the magical hat, you are magically somebody important. I think the Orthodox Jewish community, particularly the yeshiva community, has kind of fallen into that developmental trap. I think that, Orthodox Judaism after World War II was probably something like a startup company. A lot of people were no longer here. It was a small, intimate group, and they had a major task of rebuilding. And they took a lot of pieces and put it together in an informal way, and it really worked well. But, you know, as all startup companies, once you reach a certain level of growth, you can't maintain informal policies anymore, and you can't fly by the seat of your pants. Things start to fall apart. And I think that's what we're starting to see. So they made a lot of ideas that, in concept, are based on real things, but it became distorted and almost a caricature, like a child that thinks being an adult is wearing a hat and holding the car keys, not about being responsible or earning a living. And funny choice, right? Not about being responsible or earning a living. I think that there's a lot of that kind of mimicry of Torah values that, on the one hand, if you're not looking at it too closely, it looks like it's real, but then it's not really. See, there's a tshuva of Rav Moshe. somebody asks him, the great part about Rav Moshe is people would ask him the craziest things, and he would answer. He was a very patient man, like Hillel. He would answer questions. So someone asked him, is it a problem with tznius if you're going out with a girl and you ask her to make a meal for you, because maybe it's a problem with tznius, she's making a meal for you, but you want to see if she's a good cook? It was a question somebody asked, I don't know when, 60 years ago, whatever. But he patiently answers the question. He actually weighs and measures some of the halachic issues involved, which is not for today's conversation. But in the end, he makes a comment. And he says, let me tell you something. You really shouldn't be trying too hard. He said, basically, you check out the family and see if they have similar values to your family. And the person should be pleasing to your eye. And the rest is, you go out a few times, because we're litvish, and that's our hishtadlus, to go out a few times. And then you'll be successful. Hashem will bless your actions. Very profound. Very simple, very profound. If only it worked for everybody that way. But that was his advice. And I think that that's, in theory, the dance that people are trying to do. They want to find out about the family and the values, which makes sense. They want to see somebody that's attractive and feel that attraction. That makes sense. But somehow or another, it's been blown up and exaggerated in this distorted way. That people are mimicking a process that's not authentic. And that's my comment here.
Just to ask you a question. Like, really? You see a person, you check out the family, you go out a few times, and that's it? That doesn't seem strange to you? I understand you don't want to go out and, like, live with a person for 5 years, but, like, what happened to a process where you actually spend some time, not two dates, and actually talk about real things, and, like, find out, like, real people, like, falling in love? Like, it seems very odd to me that that would be a paradigm for Jewish dating.
I think it really depends. See, his comment is very telling. In the tshuva, he says, we're litvish, we go out a few times, that's our shtadlis, right? That's our effort. That means that each community has its norm, what's considered its effort. Now, if Moshe came from a Russian town in Luban, by the way, it's very interesting, his first psak that he ever made was how to spell Luban in a get. Now, you have to understand, in Luban, do you think the same people lived there for 500 years? They lived and died in the same town. How could they not have known how to spell Luban in a get? The answer was, there probably wasn't a get written in 500 years before the Bolshevik Revolution and all the social change. But anyway, he lived simply. So obviously, today things are more complex. So you don't go out 3 times. So you go out 20 times. And your conversations about trying to understand each other's values and your goals. But you don't have to kvetch and go out for 4 years either to understand that. That's my point.
So I'm going to just talk briefly about the resume. I don't think you can fight the system. I think you need to have a resume. I think that it's the easiest way to get your information out there and for people to share. I have a girl, I have a guy, let's talk about it. The challenge is making your resume stand out, which is kind of similar to applying for a job.
Can I just cut in, because I don't know about this stuff?
Yes.
Describe the resume to me. Like, how long is it? What's on it?
Sure. So similar to real life, you want it to be one page. I'll break it down for you. Aliza Abrams, hometown, Teaneck, New Jersey. Location of parents, Teaneck. Location currently, Washington Heights. High school, Mayanot. Seminary, Midrash HaMoriah. Stern College, Wurzweiler. So now you know where I went to school. My siblings, which is crucial to who I am, Dina, married to Moshe, 3 children, David, not married, Brooke, engaged. Okay, a little bit about Aliza now. Aliza lives in Washington Heights, she works for Yeshiva University, and she enjoys spending her time volunteering, and in addition, she's known for making the best challah in Washington Heights. Smiley face. Now, why did I include that? Because I needed to jump off the page, because clearly you see I have a bit of a personality, but I don't think that if someone's shuffling through papers, they're going to see who I am. So I include also, I would like to live in Israel one day, I have an open home, I host a lot of meals, etc. And I try to include as in briefly as possible the 30 years of my life, so that people can maybe try and understand who I am. So that's what a shidduch resume is. and I'll just say, though, that the fact that we have to put ourselves onto paper is really hard because people think that they're marrying a paper and not a person sometimes, and they get very hung up on the nuances of certain words that are used and things, the way that they're written or listed, and that's where people just say no. And we've all been to a Jewish wedding, we've all been to a smorgasbord. First you make your way around the room, then you decide what you're going back to. That's how dating is. You look through your pile, okay, maybe this one, maybe this one, maybe not that one, okay, fine, this one, and the problem is that the stack gets higher and higher, and so you go out with less and less. And that's the problem with the resumes, but you can't fight it. You have to have one.
Every time I go to a shvorg now, I'm going to think about shaduchim.
It's delicious.
Let's talk a little bit, all of us, about some of the other parties involved that have been mentioned here. Obviously, shadchanim, parents. I'd like you to clarify for me. What's the role of a shadchan, actually? In other words, what are some of the misconceptions do we have about their role? In the course of doing research for this, I spoke to a number of parents, and parents seem to complain a lot about shadchanim. They say they're frustrated by their conversations with them, and then the shadchanim I spoke to said they're all frustrated with the conversations they have with the parents. So why is this happening? What's the shadchan actually supposed to do? I know that sounds like a stupid question. Of course, it's supposed to put the two people together. But what further are they supposed to do?
Go ahead. Yeah. Okay, great. So first and foremost, the shadchan needs to listen. They really need to listen to what the person is saying that they're interested in meeting in terms of another person. I've found that sometimes the shadchan will say, well, tell me the last person you went out with. Clearly that did not work, so I'm not really sure why I need to give that as an example. The other challenge is I've been invited to sit in shidduch meetings, and I'm not knocking shadchanim, but I'm just going to share one vignette. And I heard a shadchan say, I cannot set that guy up with that girl. She's not the right look for him. I'm sorry, why are you deciding what he should be dating? It doesn't matter what your opinion is of her look. Let them meet. If you think everything else matches up, then go for it. I can proudly say that Baruch Hashem, I've made 4 shidduchim, and I've been very fortunate, and I'll tell you a story about a shidduch that I made, and it happens to be that one of the people is in the video. I had 2 friends that had met at a singles event, and the girl actually contacted me and said, I'm kind of interested in this guy, can you reach out to him? So I reached out to him, and I said, hey, this girl is interested in you. Sorry, I did not say that first. I said, hey, I have an idea. Because, right, we all have to pretend that no one's interested and you have to have the idea. We all know. Come on. So I called him and I said, I'd like to set you up with this girl. He hems and haws and goes, I don't really know. And I was like, why? And we were friendly enough that I could push him. I said, why don't you want to go out with her? She's a great girl. She comes from a great family. She's funny. I don't really want to tell you. No. You know what? We're friends. I need you to explain to me why you don't want to go out with her. She's not my look. Okay. I happen to think she's a lot more attractive than you are, but talk to me about this. He goes, she's just not my look. I said, can I tell you something honestly? She actually asked me about you. She did? Let me get back to you. Baruch Hashem, they're now married for 5 years. They have a kid. After their 3rd date, he called me and he said, if any guy ever gives you a hard time, tell him to call me first. Now, I'm not saying that that's the perfect example, but I think that sometimes there needs to be a little bit of nudging by a shadchan. However, that in the scenario when a girl, and I'm only talking as a woman, when a girl or a woman, whatever, says, I'm not interested in going out, and even if the guy wants to go out with her again, she shouldn't be made to feel bad for not wanting to go out again. I know myself better than anyone knows me, and if I didn't feel comfortable on that date or I don't find that that person is right for me, I'm entitled to that. And I think that a shadchan should play the role, literally, of Yenta the matchmaker, where they say, I met this person, this is a really nice idea. They can go as the in-between and you can ask them questions, but they shouldn't be forceful because, yes, you're a shadchan, shkayach, but You're not me, and you weren't on that date, and you weren't there when the guy didn't open the door, or he said something really weird and uncomfortable, and that's what people have to remember. And it's so frustrating being a shadchan, because I've been a shadchan also, even though I'm single, but people shouldn't give up, because you never know where you're going to meet someone and who you can introduce somebody to.
First of all, I just want to acknowledge, I know we have at least
one or two shadchanim. I know Grace Weltman is here. She's a shadchan for our community. If you're a shadchan, would you raise your hand? Okay, so if anyone would like to meet these people, I'm sure that they'll be here, and you have Sussan Basimcha that's here as well. And so that's a good thing. And these are the people that should really be answering these questions maybe when we do some Q&A. I want to talk about parents for just a second. I believe, first of all, it's a product of age, how much a parent should get involved with the shadchan and with their children's shiduchim. Obviously, if a young lady is 18 or 19 years old, parents will get it's appropriate for parents to get more involved in speaking with the shadchan. If the young lady is 23, 24, or older, I don't think it's appropriate anymore for the parents to be as deeply invested or involved with the shadchan. I do have to tell you that I know of cases, Karen was very involved, my wife was very involved with a case, where the young lady called my wife. She's over that age, she's definitely a mature adult, she's in her late 20s, and the mother got involved. And the mother, when Karen had recommended a young man, the mother called, asked some very, very, very detailed questions, and raised several objections, and Karen said, but they should meet. The boy's a good boy. I wouldn't set up your daughter with someone who's not a good boy. Let them just meet first. We both realized that we would be doing a disservice to the young man by setting up this girl with him, because he would have the shvigar from hell. And you need to know when you need to know when to let go. And I will tell you this. And I get it too when fathers call me from out of town inquiring about a young man from our community. It's perfectly appropriate for a father to want to know, are the young man or the young woman's parents, are they married, are they divorced, did the father spend any time in jail? You know, all of these things, if there's a story behind the family or there's a stigma, those are things that are appropriate for a parent to discuss. The personality of the guy and his future ambition and careers, goals, aspirations, likes, dislikes. Let your child discuss that with the shadchan and stay out of it.
The role of the shadchan is, if you have a Jew living in the shtetl somewhere and there are no women in his village or any of the neighboring villages and he wants to get married, the role of the shadchan is to help him find a lady in a distant village and make an introduction. How we reached a state today where singles can be living concentrated in a few square blocks, davening in the same shul, and the only conceivable way that they can ever meet each other and get married is if they go on the internet and find a middle-aged Rebbetzin to ask them silly questions and set them up, is mind-boggling to me. I have no idea. I can't explain it. We even saw in this video a very nice lady talking about how when she was young, people went out, they met each other, they had friends, they met through their friends, they met through their social activities, and unfortunately that doesn't exist anymore. I expected the next words out of her mouth to be, I'm going to create such opportunities. But no, I'm part of a shidduch group. The light bulb didn't go on. What's stopping people from being normal? What's stopping people from doing what worked for their parents and their grandparents for generations? I have news for you. It's a myth that the shadchan was the predominant way for singles to meet throughout Jewish history. It's a myth. People met in shul. People met through families. People met through friends. Some people met through a shadchan. But it was not the only way. It's not the Torah way. It's not the predominant way. It's not really the best way if there are alternatives. And there are alternatives, and there should be alternatives. So there is a role for the shadchan. They can help some people. I would question the methods that shadchanim use. There's a lot to talk about in terms of that. But there is a role for good shadchanim to play, but they shouldn't be running the show. There's really no reason for it. There's no reason for singles to count on shadchanim as a crutch, as the only conceivable way that they can meet people. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, take a minute and talk to me about methods.
Okay. I think it would be helpful for some people, perhaps, to meet the shadchanim in attendance. I think it would also be helpful for people to turn to somebody in the same row who they have not yet met and introduce themselves. I think that would be a nice idea as well.
I just wanted to briefly redirect to you, because Rabbi Karopkin talked about parents, and you do a lot of high-conflict couples therapy, and I'm sure that part of the conflict is organized around parents, and I wonder if you could just spend a moment from your perspective doing the work you do to talk about what you think is a good way for parents to be involved, and in what ways can parental involvement be dysfunctional?
Well, I think that there's a Russian psychologist, his name was Vygotsky, who, when I was in school, we didn't learn about him because he was behind the Iron Curtain. But he talks about something called the zone of proximal development, which is this idea that good development happens when children, really organisms, it's not only about children, but are exposed to challenges that are just in the right zone, that they aren't overwhelming and they aren't either completely being sheltered. And I think that that's the job of a good parent. He calls it scaffolding, like you put a scaffold around a building. So if you want your children to develop healthy relationships, it certainly doesn't start when they're going out on shidduchim. It starts from the earliest times of their formation of their personality. When siblings have conflict, how do the parents moderate the conflict? Do they step in and run the show? Do they encourage communication? Do they encourage problem-solving skills? So these are the kinds of things. I think parents are facilitators. Parents are shomrim. I always took objection. People would go over to us in shul if they would see one of our children who might be in one way particularly charming or attractive and say, oh, so does he belong to you? And I would say, no, he does not belong to me. I was entrusted with him for a while, which I hope we're doing a good job with. I think parents are facilitators. So there's many things that parents can do that can facilitate the growth, the judgment of their children. After they're married also, it's a little more complicated. They have to be much less involved and not put pressures on them. They don't realize that sometimes their little requests that seem on the outside like nothing to a newly married couple could be seismic. So putting pressure on them to fit some kind of role of coming to your house for Yom Tov or Shabbos or calling you, while they should do that from their point of view, you don't know what their shalom bias challenges are, you don't know what their pressures are, and you have to give couples a lot of space. There's many things that parents can do. It's really endless.
Can we just stay on this for a minute? The people who come into your office, let's say they're newly married, what sorts of fantasies do you think people have about marriage, like number one, that are damaging to them? And sort of, what's the best piece of advice you could give to somebody in that way?
Those are almost two different things.
Right.
What are the distortions that destroy relationships?
Right.
That's A and B. You know, what is the number one thing? But I will say that this has nothing to do with shidduchim, but I would say that the number one distortion that destroys relationships is an expectation that you have to have justice and fairness. It's actually a terrible distortion. You can be very happily married and in a relationship with somebody, and things are not going to be equal. Behavior in marriage should be values-based. It shouldn't be reactive, meaning that if you have somebody as your spouse, whatever values you have that dictate how you should behave toward your spouse, that should continue regardless of whatever treatment you're receiving. And it's really a halacha. It's nekama in the Torah to withhold a chesed on the basis of how you were treated prior. People do it all the time. You're angry. Somebody says something mean to you. The next morning, your spouse says good morning to you and smile, and you go, That's nekama. If you're supposed to smile and be kind and generous-hearted to your spouse, you have to do it no matter what. If you don't want to be married to them, don't be married to them. It's not an issa d'oraisa to get divorced. It is an issa d'oraisa to do nekama. So one of the greatest distortions is people in relationships are looking for fairness. That's not what you look for. What you look for is you understand what your responsibilities and your roles and what behavior you want to do. You agree on it, and you each do the best that you can without looking to see what the other one's doing. The need to exact revenge and to even and be tit for tat kills relationships.
I wanted to talk about technology, since it was mentioned in the film, and you talked about it. Obviously, we're living in a kind of new kind of dating world with the advent of technology. I'm wondering how you think it's affecting Jewish dating, and whether you see it, how you see it as helping, and how you see it as hindering the process, if you do.
I have been on the online dating sites, excuse me, YU Connect, saw you at Sinai, for I guess now at least 10 years. So clearly not so effective. But I will say that I actually find that I still go on more dates when it's somebody who knows me and is setting me up. When I get an internet suggestion and the paragraph is, you know, 3-4 sentences and the shadchan doesn't know who either of us are but thought, well, according to the algorithm you matched up, I'm much more hesitant to go out. And another thing that people don't think about is actually a safety hazard. I'm getting into a car with a stranger, someone told me many years ago, don't do. And it's very hard to take a picture and a few sentences and say, should I go out with this person? And like I was saying before about resumes in general, everyone kind of sounds the same. So you think, okay, maybe this isn't so bad. And then you speak to the person on the phone, and you're like, wow, you don't sound anything like your description. You're not outgoing or normal. And that's always weird. And the other thing that's a problem, but at the same time, like I said before with the resumes, you can't fight it. You want to have your name out there. You want to be accessible to as many people as possible. You have to have an online resume. And there are many, many organizations who are doing many shidduchim each year through these online websites. And it's tremendously easier, from what I understand, for the shadchanim to have all these profiles accessible to them. But the other point that I was going to say, but now it's escaping me, in terms of, oh yes, that I've actually gotten this, where someone will call me with a name and be like, check out his Facebook profile page. Why are you encouraging that? Now, granted, I don't have anything up there that I don't want to, that I would hide, because then I wouldn't put it up there. But we're in the day and age where we're saying, go judge a person by their status update, or by their picture, or by the latest YouTube video that they put up. Again, how is that going to tell me anything about the person that I'm supposed to go on a date with? Online dating hasn't been particularly successful for me, and honestly, I don't think it's been particularly successful for most of my friends. I actually don't have any friends except for one who got married and subsequently divorced, who met their match on a website. Everyone else has met through friends or through shadchanim. So I personally like the old school way, or meeting people in person at events and Shabbatons.
That hasn't been completely my experience. I agree that it's much better to meet through introductions, but I meet brides and grooms all the time because we have a lot of weddings, as you know, in the Bayit, and usually they meet with the rabbi at some point before the wedding, and we've had a lot of couples who have met through online dating. Many times they live in Thornhill, and they're just a few blocks away from each other. They never would have met were it not having gone online. Which brings me to another important point, and that is there are some dating services who provide so much information about compatibility that there are many people that are excluded that wouldn't normally necessarily be excluded. You know, I know this is controversial. I'm of the belief that even if one of the people is not Orthodox, but they are compatible, they should meet. And I know that there are a lot of people who don't agree with that, but I feel that if two people fall in love, like my mom and dad — my dad was not Orthodox when he met my mother, but my mother set down the rules, and she's been doing that for the last 60 years. She said, if we're going to get married, we have to have an Orthodox home, and our children have to be raised Orthodox, and we have to go to yeshiva. And my dad saw the value in it, even though he hadn't yet been ready to commit personally, and eventually that's the direction he went. And so, but that's an aside. The issue of Facebook, I feel that if you're in the Parsha, especially if you're a young lady, you better make sure that every single photo that is in your Facebook page is flattering. Because even though it may be a photo that you're very fond of, because it represents a memory that you cherish of that time when you were underneath that waterfall or with your friends and you were all sweaty and dirty and but it was just the most exhilarating moment. But you got to know that the guy that may be interested in you is going to be checking out your Facebook profile. So if you look horrible, you've just done yourself a disservice. So if you're going to use Facebook, make sure you use it responsibly.
I'm actually not on Facebook. Thank God I have real friends. If anybody wants to get to know me, they can't check my Facebook profile. They're just going to have to get to know me. There are no shortcuts. I think it's better that way. In terms of the question that you asked, modern tools give people more options, give people more choices. I think in principle it's a good thing if they're handled responsibly. It's good that people have choices. It's good that, you know, people can go on a dating website and there's 50,000 singles to choose from. And they can do simple searches and more advanced searches and have all these filtering mechanisms that are really not very helpful. It's good that it's made the world a smaller place, that people who live very far away and would never meet each other can, in theory, meet each other, but I think it's being used in a very primitive fashion. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to change. Again, I think that the role of the shadchan can be beneficial. I think the role of websites can be beneficial, but they're not being used intelligently. They're not being used in a helpful way.
What do you think is the best way for people to meet each other?
Naturally. And naturally doesn't mean singles events, because there's nothing natural about a singles event. Nothing natural or pleasant whatsoever, and that's why they don't work. That's why people wouldn't go to singles events if they knew they wouldn't meet anybody to date. It's not natural. They wouldn't be there. A natural program, that's what I've tried to bring back with End the Madness. The rule of thumb I have is if the singles could look into a crystal ball and see they would not meet anybody to date or marry at the program, would they still go? If the answer is yes, then you have a winning program. Why would they go? It's an educational opportunity. It's fun. It's a chesed opportunity. There's something valuable about the experience itself that they want to be there, and that'll bring out the best sides of their personality. The people that they meet there, they will naturally have something in common with. They'll naturally have something to talk about. It'll be a positive experience even if they don't meet somebody. Whereas your typical singles event is you hear somebody like me talk for a while, and then you have a table of refreshments, and then you have to introduce yourself with this awkward small talk. Hi, my name is Moshe. Where are you from? What do you do? And you do that 50 times, over and over and over again, trying to get married somehow. It's not natural, and it doesn't work. And there's always that couple that somehow meets, and that makes it worthwhile. See, those two people met, so everybody else should keep on going to these things. Maybe they'll be the next lucky lottery winner. It's not natural. It's not normal, and it causes singles to get frustrated and bitter and burned out. It doesn't work. Natural events are things that people would do otherwise. This is a natural event, because people are here not because they're single and they're desperately looking, although some people may be, but it's not obvious by virtue of the fact that they're here, right? So everybody in this room has something in common. They're interested in this topic. They care about the topic. It's something that we can talk about. It's something that can bring people closer together, and therefore it's a good way for people to meet. These are the things that we need to bring back.
One of the things you saw lamented on the video was a closure of venues for young men and women to meet each other. And I have made the recommendation, I'd like to make it publicly, if you're making a wedding at the Bayit, thank God for a child who's getting married, do a tremendous chesed for all of the boys' friends and all of the girls' friends, and have mixed tables for the singles. And if for some reason, because of social pressure from Rabbi so-and-so, it's pasnish, mitornish, you can't do it, then at least make a sweet table when the rabbi leaves just for singles.
Can I say one thing?
You can say many things.
I'm going to just say one quick thing. Okay. So I want to just agree with Rabbi Weissman in terms of natural meeting. I think that that's wonderful. I just don't think that it's happening enough, because I don't think people have been brought up to think that it's okay to ask somebody of the opposite gender out, and I mean that in both directions. I think that men in certainly my community are uncomfortable asking girls out for fear of rejection, just as much as girls are afraid of asking a guy out for fear of rejection. I think that there is no social acceptance, or very little social acceptance, for girls to ask a guy out. And I think that if we want to change the way people are meeting and have people meet more naturally, then we should maybe encourage people to do that. I don't know what Rabbanim are going to say about that, but I don't actually think it matters. Because you know what? If you like someone, go for it. And I think that we've conditioned ourselves to think that only if there's a go-between, even like the couple that I set up, then that's the only way to meet. And I think that we are living behind the screens and the Facebooks and the shadchanim, afraid to make a move. But you know what? I was recently going out with someone I had been friends with for a number of years, and we said, we're going to risk it. We're going to try it because we're going to see. We broke up. It wasn't worth it. It wasn't shayach in the end, but it was worth it. We gave it a shot. And if we hadn't tried that, we would have kept on going, not knowing. And I think that people are afraid of taking those risks sometimes, but people should be encouraged, because what's the worst that's going to happen? You have free coffee. Or you paid for a coffee, or maybe a few dinners, but still, you put in your hishtadlus. And I think that that's really important, that people should try things that might not sound ideal, but they should try it if there's a little bit of interest there.
Just a couple more from my end, and then I want to throw it open to the floor. There's a certain amount of controversy about the kinds of things that you're supposed to disclose or not disclose, and I think especially in the yeshiva world. You know, things about a person's health, their mental health, mental illness, things like that. I'm not sure I fully understand all the dynamics here, but I heard it brought up enough that I'm curious about what this means. And Rabbi Feuerman, maybe you can explain a little bit about this issue.
Well, we have an issue within an issue. Because we have now a culture and a society that diagnoses everything, right? So 15% of kids in school are on some kind of stimulant, because we've been told that the fact that they don't like to sit still and that the teachers are having a hard time making the material interesting is a disease. So we've given them medication. You know, I wonder if the Baal Shem Tov was on Ritalin, I wonder if we would have Hasidus today. He may have behaved better in class, in the cheder. So there's a big problem, because a real genuine issue, whether it's a health issue, a mental illness, or even a serious problem from a person's past, has to in some way be contended with, depending on how the shidduch process is, but at some point it has to be contended with and it needs to be spoken about. The problem is that now, you know, so many people are on medication for so many things, there's a tremendous amount of confusion. So, you know, bipolar was a rare diagnosis. Now they're giving five-year-olds a bipolar diagnosis. This is very hard to understand, but this is true. I'm not making this up. So there's really two problems. One is correctly assessing what really is an issue and what isn't, because being on some antidepressants or having depression or having various compulsive behaviors are basically a part of the realia of everyday life for many people, and everybody's got something. You know, on the other hand, though, holding back something that is a real serious piece of information that the person will feel betrayed about if they didn't find out can be a problem. And worse, what I found, and I heard it from more than one source and seen it happen more than one time, and I find it very, very disturbing, is you have people with, maybe they're Bali Tshuva, or maybe they ought to be Bali Tshuva, and they have a whole, you know, sexual history. And of course, their Rosh Yeshiva are advising them, you don't have to say anything, because, you know, you did Tshuva, you don't have to say anything. And a lot of times, things that are halakhically permitted are not always smart. Particularly when you're dealing with compulsive, addictive behavior, whether it's alcoholism, gambling, or sexual compulsions, the more you keep it a secret, the more you strengthen the urge and the compulsion. So there are real challenges to somebody with an addiction in their past not to divulge that, because in some ways it might set the person up for further relapse. On the other hand, though, you need a community that has to understand the reality of mental illness and conditions and not rule somebody out because of their past. And so this has to be thought through very carefully. I mean, from a halakhic point of view, you know, the correct way is that it's fair game. People could find out anything they want. You don't have to reveal it. But as the relationship turns to becoming very serious, you do need to speak about things that are significant. And again, Rav Moshe has a tshuva about this too. And he says that once there's a context and you know the person, and you know their milus and their chesronos, you know, then you have the ability to decide whether this person is right for you. You don't reveal all the problems in the beginning. And maybe that's part of the distortion of trying to answer all the questions before people even get out of the starting gate. But I do think that it is important that if there's a very serious problem, before you get engaged, this needs to be discussed. And you have to trust people to be adults and to understand context and understand merit and understand what it means. Because you can think you're marrying somebody who's totally fine and has no family history of anything, and the next day they can get hit by a bus, you know, chas v'shalom. But we can't control our futures. So we need to take things with a grain of salt. But people do need to be honest about serious flaws.
I'd like to follow up on that. So that seems perfectly sound to me. You know, you have some serious issues. You have to be straight about them. What's confusing to me about this process, and here I'll actually speak as a Baal Tshuva, what's very strange to me about this process is the linking of a person's own being to the people around them. In other words, I see lots of talk about I can't go out with her because of her sister, because of her mother, because of her grandfather, because of her uncle. If I was going to be judged that way, I wouldn't have gotten married. You know, it's, in other words, I am who I am. My family is who they are. I love them. They're not from. And, you know, I've lived various kinds of lives and deal with it or don't deal with it. But it seems very odd to me that the essence of a human being is being judged by people around them as if we could somehow control. We don't choose our families. We don't choose our past on some level. They are what they are. Why should this be a factor in a boy meets girl, find out of each other, decide, flesh it out, find out about your families, go through all the raw stuff, and decide? Why should that be in any way involved?
I don't think it has to be. I think that it really depends on who you are and your context. The we're progressing, right? The Western man is much more an individual. Right, I can tell you that my grandfather never in his whole life asked himself how he's feeling. And I don't know if he was happy or not, but he never asked himself. He saw himself as an extension of an experience. He actually was a grandchild of a Rebbe, and he himself was, if it wasn't for the Holocaust, would have been one himself. And he never asked himself that question. In fact, it was such a difference, you know, the self-other differentiation, which we call pathological, if it doesn't exist, but a lot of it's context. If I would disagree with him, it wasn't that he heard that I was disagreeing. It's like if your right hand starts disagreeing with your left hand. He simply did not hear it. It'd be impossible that I would disagree with him. I'm just a part of a chain. So, you know, the identity and the way identity is formed is very different for different people from different cultures. And as I mentioned before, we're in transition. So it really does depend, right? If you're somebody from a traditional background, the family has a tremendous amount of influence on you, positively and negatively, and people have a right to want to factor that in. Is it wise? Is it always true? You don't have to go further than the Talmud. You know, one of the greatest love stories of all time is, you know, Rachel sees Rabbi Akiva, who himself is an unlettered, although very fine in some ways, but unlettered person, literally an unlettered person. And she comes from this family with all the yichus and all the wealth, and she puts her foot down and says, this is the man for me. And this story is celebrated in the Gemara, although very cognitive dissonantly, not celebrated in yeshivas. All the Gemaras that don't fit into the worldview are eschewed. But she makes a stand, right, and says, I want to marry him. Her father doesn't go for it at all, and you know that he resorts to cutoff, which is oftentimes a strategy of families that do have poor self-other differentiation. They choose that you don't exist. So Kalvos Avua said, Rabbi Akiva and Rachel do not exist anymore, and let them starve, right? But I think the answer is we have to decide that, but the information needs to be disclosed, and families have to figure out what they stand for. Values count. Your values, your family's values, but these are part of values. How much do you take into account an individual?
Okay. Anybody else want to?
Yeah. If the strategy is to con somebody into marrying you under false pretenses and hope that somehow it'll work out down the road, then by all means, people can answer the questions the way they're expected to answer the questions, go out on a minimal number of tightly scripted dates, follow the script very, very closely, and then qualified people like Rabbi Feuerman can help them pick up the pieces when things start going sour, because they probably will at some point. I don't think that's the best approach. And frankly, I feel very sorry for somebody who is in a marriage but has never been able to share his true self with the person that he's living with and supposedly sharing life with because he's afraid of not being accepted. What a lonely, dark place that must be to live in. What terrible suffering, what a burden that person must be carrying every moment of his life, where he's hiding from his spouse, who should be the closest person in his life to him. I don't know why anybody would choose that. as a first choice. Now, of course, there's a time and a place and a context for sharing certain things, but ultimately, I think everybody wants to be loved for who they really are, flaws and all, and there's a time and place to share these sensitive things, and that will bring people closer to one another.
There are halakhic parameters to what can be revealed, but they're really, I think it's beyond the scope of this discussion, but if people have questions, they can call their rabbi.
I would like to finish with, in a way, the question that interests me personally the most. There seems to be a kind of paradox. I'm thinking here about Jewish people getting married today in the Orthodox world. Almost a kind of perfect storm. And the perfect storm sort of goes like this. Jewish law forbids premarital sexuality, which would seem to then encourage early marriage as a means of fulfilling perfectly natural and healthy sexual desire, especially in males. On the other hand, we all know that in modernity, there's been a vast sociological shift in which people are marrying later, and they're marrying later for very identifiable reasons, because there's longer years spent in study, either in yeshivot or in universities or other academic institutions. They're getting degrees, they're establishing careers. And many singles say they would not be ready to marry younger, even from the point of view of emotional readiness and financial stability, and so on. So that to me is a paradox, which, you know, I guess you can solve if your parents have a lot of money and they're going to support you, or you meet the love of your life when you're 18 years old. But otherwise, I'm sort of curious, like, how do we solve this paradox, right? You've got sex on the one side, but you've got non-readiness on the other side. And if you're solving it by just saying, okay, I jump in, I'm 20, I'll jump in anyway, there's probably going to be some kind of fallout on the other end if you're not ready. So how would you sort of see this? Anybody?
I think it's certainly ideal for people to get married young if they're able to. I don't think anybody should get married one day before they are ready. Now, who is ever really ready for marriage? We don't know what marriage is until we experience it. So nobody's totally ready, but you're close to being ready. That's when people should get married. There's no magic number in terms of age. It varies from person to person. But people who are not yet ready should be, you know, stridently working to get ready as soon as possible, just as they're working on other life goals, whether it's schooling, jobs, etc. This should be at the top of the list of things to do. This is really the most important thing. My Rebbe, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, many years ago at the very first End the Madness event, which is available online on the website, and I strongly encourage everybody to listen to the audio of that, he said that young couples, when they get married, they start off at the bottom. They're not necessarily going to have a large apartment handed to them on a silver platter. They're not necessarily going to have a lot of money. They've got to start at the bottom and work their way up. That's what their parents and grandparents did. You don't wait until you're already established and then you get married. You have to start off and grow with the person. So I think people should try to get ready as early as possible and navigate the other challenges in life with that partner and kind of figure things out. I think that's the best way to do it.
I think the greatest success of traditional Judaism is the ban on premarital sex. And the reason why I believe that is because that's the reason, the very fact that that taboo does not exist in general society is why the institution of marriage has been broken down in society. Because, quite simply, without the sexual tension and desire that a young man, especially a young man, and to a certain degree a young woman has to be intimate with someone else, if you were to speak to an alien who just came to this planet from somewhere foreign, somewhere outside of the planet Earth, and tried to explain to them the institution of marriage and said, we have this thing where you give another person a ring who's totally not from your family and say that you have to take care of each other for the rest of your lives for no reason other than the fact that you made that promise to each other. The alien would say, why? What's the point? Right? And the reason why marriage works, has worked in civilization, is because a big part of it is the sexual component to it. I believe that every human being is driven to a very large degree by their sexuality, and the reason why some people get married young is because of that desire, and if the desire is great enough, you'll figure out a way to surmount the financial challenges and the emotional challenges that you may have. There are people, I think, who don't allow their sexuality to play the role that it's supposed to play in incentivizing them to enter into a marriage because the scariness and the fear of entering into a commitment outweighs the sexual desire. So I would just suggest that we should emphasize the taboo on sex before marriage, and we'll have more marriages in Klal Yisrael.
I have a different thought about the matter, which is that I think you alluded to it very briefly when you talked about normal urges, normal basic human desire. I think that the mistake that we've made actually is not recognizing the normalness of sexual desire. And there is, what does it mean not to be ready to be married? It certainly doesn't mean being able to earn a living. Clearly, whether we approve of this lifestyle or not, there are people from several different cultures who marry and have oodles of children without the scintilla of an ability to support themselves, both from Jewish culture and from the secular culture. You know that sometimes I'm involved in writing grants, and you have to make a case, you know, for a population at risk. So we were talking about a certain neighborhood having an enormously high proportion of teenage mothers. Of course, the federal government didn't know they all were married by the time they were 16. But we were talking about a particular Jewish neighborhood that had a huge percentage of teenage mothers. So a lot of it has to do with, you know, how you sort it out. In any case, what I'm trying to say is being ready to be married is an emotional piece. It's a decision, and it also, you know, takes certain emotional skills, the ability to relate to another, the ability to shoulder responsibilities. Communities, whether you're from the modern Orthodox community or you're from the yeshiva community, needs to acknowledge that we need to be realistic about what it takes to help a couple succeed. And there's no way that a frum couple can succeed without some parental help and get married at an early age. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing shameful about that. It might be insane to think that you have to support 10 children who still are not earning a living. But the idea that they need help and should get help and we should devote ourselves toward that, that's a wonderful thing. It's an artificial distinction that until you support yourself 100%, first of all, in the frum world with tuition and camp and everything, poverty level is $150,000, $200,000 a year. This is ridiculous. You can't do it. I think the whole frum community actually is being supported by one 99-year-old Holocaust survivor who made $1 million selling things from China or something. We don't even know how the frum community supports itself. But the point is, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's a solution. We need to normalize it and encourage people. They can get married and come up with practical solutions for couples to support themselves and get support and get education and get training. They don't need to be supported forever. But there's no shame that couples need help to start out. They all do.
I just want to add one piece in terms of deciding when one is ready to get married. I think it's a decision that a young person should make with the help of their parents and not their friends. I think that social peer pressure plays a large role in when someone decides that they're ready to get married. I remember I was Shana Bet, and my friends had gone back to Stern already, and they started dating, and I was freaking out because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to come back. There's not going to be anybody left. And I'm still in seminary. How come they're getting married? And I certainly was not ready to get married at that stage. And I don't even know if I was ready to get married when I was 20 or 21. And who knows? Maybe if I would have been married. Whatever. But the point is that I think that often kids or single people turn to their friends for advice in these situations because they don't want to talk to their parents about it. But the problem is, why don't they want to talk to their parents about it? And it might be the way that the conversation is coming up. And I know that I have friends who do not talk to their parents at all about dating. They will not talk about it because that's the one thing that they fight about. And we need to avoid finding ourselves in those contentious conversations. And I think that, to an extent, my generation of people who are single is a phenomenon, because the people who are a generation or two generations older than us did not have this huge number of single people, and therefore their parents did not deal with it the same way or know how to deal with it. And I mean, I mentioned before, I have a younger sister who's getting married, my second younger sister who's getting married in Ritz Hashem soon, and my mom is beside herself that I am not married. Now, it doesn't matter how many times I tell her, Mom, it's going to be okay. You know, and the thing is that to an extent, her feeling so bad for something she has nothing to really do with makes me feel worse. But again, it's the approach of the conversation, because when she says it's just coming from a place of love, then I don't resent the fact that she's crying herself to sleep more than I'm crying myself to sleep, you know? And I think that it's important that when it comes to starting to date and going through this process, that you ask your child, when do you want to talk about it? Not, I want to talk to you about it per se. And I'm not a parent, I'm just a child. But I do think that it's a very weird and new relationship for so many people that it's hard to navigate. But I think that kids get very defensive and therefore don't necessarily talk about it, when really the parent is the best person to talk to about it.
If you want to ask a question of the panel, I suggest you line up behind the mic, because I'm going to turn to you in just a minute. Last piece, quick, 30 seconds, best piece of dating advice.
Best piece of dating
advice. Best piece of dating advice you got.
I'm not into sound bites, but I'll give you one. Be real and be normal. That's all I've got. Just be your real self and trust in Hashem and trust in yourself and trust in the people who care about you, that you'll find somebody who loves you just the way you are. You don't have to play some sick game. Just be real and be normal.
Okay. Billy Joel. Go ahead.
Spend some time preparing yourself for the date and make yourself look nice.
I'll give two quick sound bites. One is, come with a plan. I do not like getting into the car and the guy's like, so what do you want to do tonight? I don't know. What do you want to do tonight? Have a plan. And number two is, be careful with the kinds of questions that you ask of a single person. I don't ask you personal questions about your marital relationship. You don't have to ask me super personal questions.
Look for somebody that you genuinely enjoy spending time with. You're going to be spending a lot of time together if you're successful.
Let's give a warm hand to our panelists. What I've concluded this evening is there's no way I could date today. go ahead.
Oh.
Yeah. It's showtime.
Hi. Hello, panel. I have a question. I remember that earlier in the panel you mentioned about how people are being too picky when it comes to finding a date or a shidduch. I am looking for someone who has a certain interest as I am, but it might be a bit hard to find someone with that interest in the Orthodox Jewish community. So to find someone with something that I have in common with the person that isn't so common in the Orthodox Jewish community, would that be a little too picky?
All right, you got to tell us what it is.
No, you don't. That's personal. Bekavod, bekavod.
I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you what the research shows. The research does show that happily married couples do not have to enjoy the same things. However, there's a very big but. The but is that they do need to feel that the other person truly is interested and supports their goals. So you can have somebody, you can have a Rebbetzin married to a titan on Wall Street, and they could come home for dinner together, and she could talk about how she taught her students this great Rashi, and he can talk about how he just merged three companies and laid off 300 people. And it sounds strange, but if they truly, really care about the other person's life goals, and that is partially a natural inclination and partially a decision. Marriage is a decision of loyalty, and it's not fake. And they show real concern and interest, that relationship can be successful. Having said that, of course, it's nice to share things in common, and you can look for those things. But I'm just telling you what the research shows.
Anybody else?
Picky is a very loaded word. If you're going to spend the rest of your life with somebody and build a home and a family with them, I think you should be picky. Just be picky about the right things and not the wrong things. Be picky about values, personality, character. Do you actually enjoy each other's company? Do you like each other? Do you care about each other? Those are the things that you should be picky about. Everything else is really flexible. In terms of shared interests, I think it's a bonus, but it's really not a requirement. I personally love softball. I would not expect my wife to, you know, join me at every softball game and watch because she cares. And if she likes opera, maybe I'll go once in a while just because that's what you have to do. But hopefully she has other friends to fill that void in her life. That's not the responsibility of a spouse.
And I'll just add one last thing, Mr. Genisov, and that is many of us in this room have secret hobbies that many other Orthodox Jews might not have.
Okay, we're listening. What's yours? What's your secret hobby?
Well, no. I don't mind sharing it. When I was growing up, I was madly into comic books, and so when my wife and I first got married, I said, you know, my idea of a good vacation is to go to comic book shops when we go to various vacation destinations and see what I can find, you know. And so my wife was fine with that. She'll look for jewelry and I'll look for my comic books. You know, so. And you know, if you like wearing Star Wars memorabilia and waving this lightsaber around in front of a camera and that's your idea of a fun time, and you know, first get to know the girl, let her get to know you. I think a lot of women would find that charming, that, you know, there's a little quirk about a guy that, you know, okay, so you're not the conventional guy. Conventionality is overrated.
Hi, my name is can you hear me? Hello? My name is Louis Burston, Toronto. I'm single. I have some lady friends here who are single. And I have a question here. My question is in the realm of meeting singles. I know some of you don't agree that that's the only avenue to meet singles and single events, but it always appears that way that, like for my lady friends, that there's a lot more men the opposite. There's a lot more women at the single events, right? So do you think that's part of the Shidduch crisis, part of the problem with Shidduch crisis? And also, do you think, why do you think that there's more women than men? Or is it maybe women are more serious? And men are less serious?
Can I answer that?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
This is also, I'm happy to tell you, this is also a myth and it's propaganda, and I'm actually able to demonstrate it and tell you why. I'm not a scientist, but I think I can give you a pretty reasonable answer to this, okay? There are not more women than men out there. There's plenty of guys out there. God knows how many of each he put into the world, and he knows what he's doing. I trust his counting mechanism. I once ran a program many years ago. I thought it was very clever. It was called Speed Chess, and I advertised it. I was really proud of myself. Speeding is fun, but not legal. Chess is legal, but not fun. Speed chess, legal and fun. And it was a speed chess tournament with the clocks and everything around Robin, where everybody would play a quick game of chess with everybody else in the room, and they would give them an opportunity to meet. And the proceeds of the event would go to the charity of the winner's choice. So there was a chesed component built into it. It was something different. It was fun. It was clever. Approximately 20 guys showed up, not one woman. So if there was a shotgun in the room, they'd say, wow, there's so many great guys, where are all the women? And the guys were really good guys, by the way. They were educated, they were personable, they were really good people. And if women showed up to this event, they would have been very pleased with who they found. So I went on my website and I blasted the women, which you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to always have sympathy. And I said, where were you tonight? Why didn't you come? And they yelled back at me, well, we're women, we don't like to play chess. I said, well, you're willing to go to the shotgun and play that game. You're willing to post a personal ad on the internet. But playing a game of chess to meet a guy, that's just crossing all boundaries. I can't do that. That's too uncomfortable for me. I think the reason why your typical singles event has more women than men, and your typical shotgun knows more women than men, and your typical singles website has more women signed up than men, which leads to a perception that there are more women than men, is because it caters to the female mindset. I'm not interested in having a good experience. I'd actually rather have no fun whatsoever. I want to get right down to business, have a really rotten time at this event, but meet a husband and get out of here really fast. That caters to the female mindset. The guy wants to get married too, but he wants to relax. You know, I want to have a good time. I want to get to know somebody gradually. I'd rather avoid all that pressure and awkwardness. So guys shy away from these things. And since all that's being offered to singles right now is stuff that's full of pressure and awkwardness that caters to the female mindset, I just want to get married and get right down to business, so the men kind of shy away from it. And that leads to a perception that there are not a lot of single guys. They're out there. Just give them an opportunity for something that's relaxing and enjoyable, and they'll come.
And now begins the War of the Roses.
Thank you, Hananya, for that opening. As the woman on this panel, I just want to say my favorite pastime is attending singles events. I mean, I know who doesn't love to go to those. I like to have fun. I do also want to get married. I don't know if I would have seen an advertised event of playing chess I would have gone, because I don't know how to play chess. And that's a little intimidating to me, and I don't think that that does sound fun. If you had a bowling event or you had some activity that I like to do, then maybe I would attend. But that doesn't mean that I don't think your event is important or that I want to get married any less. So I'm not sure exactly if it's catering to the women the way that events are run. I do think that when we say there are more women at events or more women in Shadchanim's, folders, it's because I don't often think that, from what I understand, and I won't speak on behalf of men, that men don't need the service as much because perhaps they're getting more phone calls than the average woman is, or they are meeting people more naturally than girls are, who, like I said earlier, are not going to go up to somebody and ask them out, whereas a man might feel more comfortable doing that. And I don't think that any event is really played towards either gender that I've ever attended. I think that people want to get people into a room so that people will meet and people will get married. That doesn't mean that the right people are in the right room for each other, which could be the problem. And I think that it's something that Rabbi Kropkin said earlier about if someone's a little bit less religious, then you can still set them up. I don't think that that's the case today. I think that we're living in a very different time than when your parents were dating, because we've become so siloed and we've been forced to check things off on a checkoff list where I identify, and therefore we've taught ourselves not to be flexible. So I don't disagree with you in theory, but unfortunately, I'm not going to go to an event that's for modern Orthodox light. I'm only going to go to an event that's modern Orthodox machmir, because that's who I am. And I think that's a big problem, but that's what I'm supposed to do.
But that also may address why there's a perception of more ladies than men, is because the ladies on their checklist say the guy's got to daven three times a day, he's got to be kovei itim l'Torah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are plenty of guys, but they're not into learning. And sometimes they do sleep in, and they don't go to mincha all the time. So my question to you is that a reason to apostle the guy?
So I'm going to talk from very, very personal experience. If I was getting the number of men offered to me that people might think that I am, that I was turning down, that I would say, okay. But I will literally get a suggestion once every 6 months. I'm 30 years old. How am I going to get married if I'm getting a suggestion once every 6 months? You want to set me up with someone who doesn't daven three times a day? I'll go out with him as long as he's a good guy, because I want to get married. But the problem is that people are not actually setting people up often enough, or people are not meeting often enough. And there are wonderful shadchanim out there who are banging their heads against the walls trying to set people up, but it's not happening. And I do think that people at this stage in their lives, and I'm talking about people who are in their late 20s and 30s and 40s, are much more willing to go out with people who are different than them hashkafically. But it's not even becoming an option because people aren't introducing them. And that's a really big problem.
Just to say something humorous first, quickly. I always tell my friends that it's the men are under the rocks, hiding the rocks.
That's where they are.
I see.
First of all, I want to say thank you. This is a really important topic and one that I care a lot about, so I want to thank you all for being here. So what I guess I want to do, because I've got so much going on in my head, especially after the film and all
just
of what you're saying, I want to share a couple of things that I'm noticing that I think maybe hasn't been addressed so much tonight, why I think a lot of people are still single and having a hard time. It sounds to me and it seems to me like a lot of people are not being taught. They may be being taught Torah. They're not being taught things that make them more mature. They're not being taught midos enough. I don't see enough of an emphasis on that. And a lot of times in the Orthodox world, it seems like they're not being taught whatever it is that will keep them from being socially awkward so that they can approach and date in a healthy, respectful, comfortable, fun way. Another thing that I think is a problem, and I just want to get your response to this, if any of this resonates with any of you.
Can I take that point right there?
Please.
I want to redirect that into a question for you, because you talked before about, Daniel Goleman talks about emotional intelligence and a certain social skill set, and it does seem sometimes that because of this kind of separation of the sexes, that this kind of emotional skill set has been a deficit. And I'm wondering if I think the questioner is asking, like, we need to model and teach this stuff more. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. The degree of gender separation, I think all of us in the room are reacting to, that somehow, again, it's a caricature of a Jewish idea that has its place but has gone amok. I only could tell you, you know, what my wife and I did, and we've always done. Since we already married two off, so, you know, if they find out about it, we'll probably be okay anyway, just on the inertia. But what we, you know, we did is we always encouraged not to have, you know, just fraternization, but we encouraged if different families got together for Shabbos and there were boys and girls and they were at the table, they would talk of all ages. We never got all uptight about that, even though we're from, a more right-wing yeshivish background, because we felt that you got to learn how to talk to each other. You just have to. So if there was Divrei Torah at the table, we'd encourage exchange. We'd look forward to those opportunities. We wouldn't let things get out of hand. We really felt that was important and that there wouldn't be an awkwardness. And I think that there is a problem in tafasta b'merubah lo tafasta. You try to go too far in something, you really don't achieve the desired results. So and I think that there always was mingling of sexes. It's very clear. I don't think people lived in cloisters. So that's my personal, you know, reaction to it.
Right. There's a historical video called Things Not to Say on a Shidduch Date. It's on YouTube. I recommend it if you want to see a caricature of social awkwardness.
There's such a long line of people. We're going to limit it to one at a time. If you don't mind. Sorry.
The other part that it's really short and really important.
Really, there's a long line. Come on.
I want to applaud the caliber of speakers tonight. Thank you very much. Also, I see intermarriage as a crisis. And my question is now, speaking to Elisa's point, I find many people are reluctant to fix people up because they're afraid of the consequences if it doesn't work out. And they just don't want to get involved. What would you say to those people?
I have a quick line that I learned from someone who got married when she was in her late 30s. Love me a little less, set me up a little more.
Can I also respond quickly?
Yeah, please.
The word I hear so much tonight besides shidduch is fear. Fear of rejection, fear of being hurt, fear of what the other person will say or think or getting involved. You know what? Dating hurts. Sometimes you have to allow yourself to be hurt in order to find love. That's part of life. That's part of growing up. And you just got to get over it. Otherwise, you shouldn't be dating. It's part of life.
Okay, we're just going to have a couple more because the hour is late.
Go ahead. One of the local rabbis, Rabbi Weber, he mentioned that he had hosted a bunch of guys in their mid to later 20s one Friday evening. And they told him that they were afraid to get married. And I asked him about it, and he said many of them had friends who were in horrific marriages, and some were in horrific divorces. And so what you touched upon, Rabbi, was that the mother-in-law from hell. I mean, the fact is, I think there are people out there who have personality disorders, who are dysfunctional, maybe because of their parents or because of other situations. And I just want to mention that I think it would be very beneficial if therapists like you went into the high schools, the girls' high schools, and the yeshivot, and taught the kids what to look for, the red flags that would show them that maybe the person they're dating could have a personality disorder or some significant flaw that would not make them a healthy relationship. And this way they'll have more confidence to go when they date, to recognize problematic people, and then they might not be so afraid of falling in.
Thank you. One more, if there is one more. That's it. We're good. Thank you all very much for coming.